dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We are escorting you about the battle space of the war for the free world and doing so with the best of the business, starting with our friend and colleague, an adjunct fellow at the Center for Security Policy, a fellow with the David Horowitz Freedom Center, a Jerusalem Post columnist and author of Shackled Warrior, Carolyn Glick, and she joins us now from Israel. Carolyn, since we last talked, there have been some major changes in the lineup of the Israeli government. Tell us what happened and then what you think it means for Israel's policies, particularly with respect to Iran and the so-called peace process.
Well, I think mainly the people who were mostly shocked and affected by it was the Israeli media, because they managed to be left out of the loop completely and were pretty angry about that. But last week, the Prime Minister Netanyahu surprised everyone by bringing in the largest opposition party, Kadima, into his government. So now, with Kadima, out of 120 seats in Israel's parliament, the Knesset, 94 are occupied by members of his coalition government. So that means that he has effectively ended his political opposition. He blunted the force of Israel's political opposition because he just co-opted it. So from that perspective, he has an incredibly powerful government. He postponed elections that were due to take place in September and about a year and a half short of their scheduled date, and so bought himself a year and a half of quiet in which he can run Israel without any threats to his government.
Now, Carolyn, as I understand it, this was made possible by a change in leadership in the Kadima party, replacing a woman I know you did not have much use for, Tzipi Livni, with a former Israeli general, quite respected individual, Shaul Mofaz. Tell us what that change of leadership means in the coalition government for Benjamin Netanyahu's policies towards, if he has to, act against Iran's nuclear weapons program and government, perhaps, this so-called two-state solution.
Well, it's not clear that it's going to have any impact on that, because if there had been elections in September, Likud under Netanyahu was, by all estimates, going to win and win by a large majority. And Kadima, the party that is now the largest faction in the Knesset, was going to be reduced to probably a third of its current power, so from 28 members to somewhere around 10 in the Knesset. So Shaul Mofaz didn't do this for ideological reasons. He did it because he didn't want to be blamed for the demise of his own party in the upcoming elections. And so from Kadima's perspective, this is a question of the political survival of the party, at least for another year and a half, until the voters get to say their piece at the ballot boxes. So I don't think it's going to have any impact on Israel's position on Iran. I think that Mofaz isn't in a position to object to anything that Netanyahu does. And aside from that, I don't think that he really has any objection in principle to preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. There's wall-to-wall support in Israel for preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. As for the Palestinians, Netanyahu has been very forthcoming over the past 3.5 years in power to the notion of negotiating with the Palestinians. It's been the Palestinians who have refused to negotiate with Israel, and that is not liable to change, because the Palestinians are not being moved by Israeli actions in their determination of their own policies. What Israel does doesn't affect them. What affects them more than anything else is what's happening in the Arab world, and what's happened in the Arab world, particularly in the last year, has been a rise of Islamic forces, most importantly on Israel's southern border in Egypt. And so the Palestinians, the leadership, the purportedly secular or moderate leadership of the Palestinian Authority of Fatah, is not going to stick its neck out and make peace with Israel when the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt is now on the chopping block, and the Jordanian regime that made peace with Israel is hanging on by a thread.
Mm. So these are, I guess, questions that there's a consolidation of position by Netanyahu. And from an American perspective, when the Obama administration was clearly trying to dissuade the Israeli government from taking steps to protect its people from an existential threat in Iran and coerce it, perhaps certainly induce it to make further concessions to the Palestinians, that under the new order of things in Israel sounds like it's not on. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I don't think that there's going to. I don't think that the Obama administration is going to meet with a more flexible Israeli government in terms of either Iran or the Palestinians as a consequence of Kadima's joining the coalition.
Carolyn, we're again speaking with Carolyn Glick of the Jerusalem Post. She's a columnist there. She is also the author of a marvelous book, Shackled Warrior, and a contributor to our programming with some regularity, for which we're very grateful. Let's talk about an event that's taking place here in the United States this week. Turkey, a one-time close, well, I guess ally partner, at least, of Israel, under the Erdogan regime, has apparently blocked Israel from participating, at least as an observer or an adjunct to the NATO meeting coming up in Chicago later this week. What's the status of Turkish-Israeli relations, and what does it mean for the two nations and perhaps the region?
Well, I think it's very dangerous. And Israel is the front line of NATO, even though it's not a member, because the fight against Israel by its neighbors, by pan-Islamic forces in the region, and in fact throughout the world, is really the front line of the jihad against the free world as a whole. And that's in recognition of that, NATO has had a very close and cooperative relationship with Israel over the past several decades, actually. And Israel has participated in NATO meetings, has participated in NATO exercises. And Turkey, over the past decade, over Erdogan, has moved from a NATO member that supports, by and large, the interests of NATO into a NATO member that is serving more and more as a fifth column for the forces in the region that are fighting NATO forces in places like Afghanistan and before the U.S. pulled out in Iraq and in general. And Erdogan really has transformed Turkey from a member of the Western Alliance into a wolf in sheep's clothing that he pretends to continue to serve as a member of the Western Alliance, NATO, and yet he tries to undermine NATO's policies in country after country. And one of the places where this has become most prominent is in his really taking a knife to what had been Turkey's strategic alliance with Israel over the past several years in a very, very open and hostile way. Rather than standing up to Turkey as it's done this over the past several years, the Obama administration has embraced Turkey and tried to distance itself from Israel so that when Turkey sent a regime support, a terrorist group called IHH, on a mission to undermine Israel's blockade of Hamas-controlled Gaza, the U.S. supported Turkey's position that Israel had to apologize for the killing of 9 IHH terrorists by Israeli naval commandos who boarded the ship in order to prevent them from harming the blockade. And the United States continues to support Turkey's demand that Israel apologize for its act of self-defense that was eminently legal. And it is Turkey's demand that Israel apologize for what it did that is used as a justification on Turkey's side for barring Israel from participating in NATO exercises and for this weekend barring Israel from sending a delegation to participate, even as an observer, in the NATO conference that's supposed to take place in Chicago.
Carolyn, we have to leave it at that. A very troubling development, as you have said, a misplaced priority on the part of the Obama administration that is, I'm afraid, only emboldening the Turks and through them. A lot of others elsewhere in the region who share Erdogan's Islamist agenda and animosity towards not only Israel but towards us. We're going to be continuing to cover this, I hope, with your help. I also commend to everyone Latma, your terrific website, where there is an outstanding, mega viral hit that addressed exactly this blockade running operation and what the Turks were up to there, featuring, among others, our guest, Carolyn Glick. Thanks so much for joining us, Carolyn. We will talk with you again very soon. Next up, Senator John Kyle talks to us about missile defense issues and the sequestration impact on your security. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any other junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by a man I regard above all others in the United States Congress on either side of the aisle, in either body. He is John Kyle, Senator from the great state of Arizona, sadly about to lay down the mantle of leadership that he currently has been exercising in the Senate with great distinction as the Senate Minority Whip as he approaches retirement. But in the meantime, he is firing for effect, including in a major address to the Heritage Foundation last week and in a very important op-ed article in the Wall Street Journal just yesterday. And it's a great pleasure to have him back to discuss the themes, the issues that he's been trying to make sure are not lost sight of in these budget-driven times when we are focusing almost exclusively on the economy and ignoring serious dangers around the world. Senator Kyle, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. As always, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, and always good to be with you and your listeners.
Let's talk a little bit about the op-ed piece first and foremost. You were writing about missile defense is self-defense, and seemingly uncontroversial proposition, and yet one that the Obama administration seems to be missing.
what's going on here, and what should we be thinking about it?
Well, I think they know full well that it's self-defense, but Barack Obama himself has declared that he is no fan of missile defense, and the Russians have been pushing him very hard to give up on some of our missile defense plans, to limit the capability of our missile defense system as it might affect them. And as the open mic incident of a few weeks ago demonstrated, he's perfectly willing to do that, but not until after the election, when he can no longer be held accountable by the voters.
He'll be more flexible, as he put it.
Exactly. And I think what he has in mind is giving them political assurances that he will not permit the development of a system that could be effective against the Russians. Now, prior to the START treaty debate, he promised us that, and this was done in several different ways because we were concerned about it, that he would not agree to any limits on U.S. missile defenses, no written assurances to the Russians. And so I think they understand they're not going to get something in writing, but I also think that the wink-wink nod-nod from the president is probably enough for them at the present time that we will not move forward. And he'll do that by not including it in his budget, by instructing his military people not to ask for it, and so on, and if he has majorities in either the House or Senate, to prevent them from funding it. So it's a dangerous proposition because at the current time, we have made a commitment to move forward with a phased adaptive approach, which would include in its fourth phase a missile and a radar combination, which could be effective against some of the Russian and or Chinese assets that could be launched either accidentally or by a rogue commander. We certainly wouldn't have the capability of defeating an all-out Russian attack, but at least we would have a system that could notionally be effective against Russian missiles, as well as those coming from a place like Iran.
And as you have indicated in your terrific op-ed, Senator John Kyle, what's wrong with that? If somebody
exactly
is theoretically putting our self-defense or our survival maybe even at risk, having a defense against it is our right, and we should insist upon it. You have been warning ever since that new START treaty reared its ugly head about the Obama administration's policies in this area. The Russians actually think they got a veto out of the administration in that treaty, and there's some reason to believe they were right. So this is all the more important a time to be ensuring the president shows no more flexibility, either now or after the election. Senator,
and
go ahead.
Excuse me, and the reason for writing it yesterday was that you've got this meeting in Chicago, the NATO meeting, where they're going to be talking about the NATO missile defense system. The Russians helpfully decided not to show up, so that's fine. But there's a lot of talk about the Russian cooperation with NATO, and of course they would basically like a finger on the button, a veto, as you put it. NATO is not going to give that to them, but I'm still concerned that there could be some offline concessions that give them assurances that they'd like to get.
Yeah, it's all too probable given the condition of our allies at the moment. Senator, let me ask you about something else I know you've been very concerned about, and that is the effect of this so-called sequestration mechanism on our defense capabilities and our defenses. What is happening in the Senate at the moment on that, if anything? There seem to be some steps being taken in the House to provide relief at least for a year. I know you've been trying to get something going. Is there any prospect that there might actually be this train wreck coming now avoided?
Yes, there's a prospect, but it won't be easy. First, sequestration is the fancy term for across-the-board cuts. Since the Congress was not able to agree on $1.5 trillion over 10 years of reductions in spending, each year for the next 10 years we have to cut the equivalent, a little over $900 billion, and that's divided equally between defense and non-defense discretionary spending. Imagine being told that you can have four-fifths of an airplane, but not the whole airplane. That's the way sequestration works. It's a very foolish way to cut, but we weren't able to do it in an agreement before. So what we have to do each year now is to find about $908 billion in other savings and reduce spending that way so that it doesn't have to come out of these across-the-board cuts. The Democrats have pretty much been lockstep in trying to put this off until the lame duck session, that is the time after the election, but before the new Congress comes in, because they think that'll be the point of maximum leverage for them. What we're trying to do is...
And they're seeking new taxes as the lubricant to all this.
Yes, right? Exactly. They don't want to accomplish this by savings. They say that it must be a package that includes tax increases. And the president has said he would veto any legislation. And Harry Reid, the Democrat leader, will not bring up legislation that does not include a tax increase component. So that's going to make this very difficult. But Democrats as well as Republicans have a lot of defense installations and companies in their districts. This is a loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs and a huge blow to the economy if the sequestration were to occur. But that's not even the main point. The main point is it would be devastating to our national defense. As Secretary of Defense Panetta says, it would be catastrophic. And so what
the president's own Secretary of Defense warning.
The president's own Secretary of Defense, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, said, Mr. Secretary, wouldn't this be like shooting ourselves in the foot? He said, no, Senator, this would be like shooting ourselves in the head. And indeed it would. So why the president and the Democratic leader are so cavalier about it is very difficult to appreciate. Now, what we've done is introduce legislation that would avoid this by finding savings in the budget. We have very specific ways that that would be accomplished. Buck McKeon, the House Defense Committee chairman, has similar legislation, and the Ryan budget contains a different mechanism for avoiding the sequester with other savings. And it's fine with me. Whatever we can agree on in the savings is fine. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be a combination. But we do have to reach an agreement. Our effort is for the House tomorrow to include an amendment on the Defense Appropriation, the National Defense Authorization Act, it's called the NDAA, that would provide the basis for using the Defense Act as the vehicle for resolving this situation. It would have language in there affirming that the decisions of the Authorization Committee are based on the assumption that we will avoid the sequester by finding other savings. Whatever the Senate then does, when the Senate and House go to conference, we could use that conference as the place to get this accomplished. And so we have a potential vehicle. We have a potential plan, but it's going to require some very difficult negotiating with our Democratic counterparts to bring it about.
Well, listen, we again appreciate your leadership enormously. Lastly, we've only got about a minute, Senator Kyle. The Law of the Sea Treaty is rearing its ugly head again. In your speech at the Heritage Foundation, you were quite critical, I think properly, of it. What's going to happen on that treaty in the months ahead, do you think?
If the Senate leader believes that he can get it up and off the floor in a fairly quick fashion and that he has the votes for it, I don't have any doubt that he'll try to do that. I hope and I believe that we can demonstrate to him that that won't be possible and that therefore he should probably wait and try that another time if he feels like doing it. I don't think Barack Obama would hesitate again next year if he were reelected, but if he's not reelected, I doubt seriously that the Romney administration would propose its ratification.
Yeah, and that's presumably why they're pressing to see if they can ram it through, as they did, sadly, the New START Treaty, despite your best efforts to point out its defects. I look forward to your pointing out with equal vigor and hopefully greater effect the defects of the Law of the Sea Treaty, which is an assault on our sovereignty, folks, among other things. Senator John Kyle, few people stand for our sovereignty as well as our national security and the good of the country as effectively and as steadfastly as you. We appreciate you spending a little bit of time with us talking about it today, and we look forward to supporting you in your good works in the months to come before your retirement.
Thank you, Frank. Look forward to it again.
The Heritage Foundation's Steve Groves drills down on the Law of the Sea Treaty. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Stephen Groves. He is the Bernard and Barbara Lomas Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's marvelous Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. Steve is a man that I have come to know over the years as an extraordinarily capable individual, in part drawing on his time on Capitol Hill, where he was a senior counsel to the U.S. Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, an institution I was associated with a long, long time ago. Steve is a former litigator, private practice, and has also served as an assistant attorney general for the state of Florida. A man of many parts, and thankfully he is currently bringing these many skills to bear on one of the most important and least understood public policy challenges of the day. And that is a treaty we've discussed here from time to time, but we're going to be talking a lot more about, folks, called the Law of the Sea Treaty, or LOST, as I think it's more accurately described by its acronym. Stephen Groves, you have, among other things, contributed just in the past day or so to our understanding of the problems with LOST, with the publication of a very important new product, a paper by the Heritage Foundation, a backgrounder, as you call them, entitled U.S. Accession to U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea, that's the formal title, Unnecessary to Develop Oil and Gas Resources. First, before we get into the details of that, and it's a tremendously important analysis, tell us just a little bit about the background to this treaty for those who aren't familiar with it and why we should all be concerned about it.
Sure. Thanks, Frank, and thanks for having me on. Many of your listeners probably haven't heard about this treaty, even though it's been around for 30 years. You know, we go all the way back to the Reagan administration, and he was the first one who had a chance to either go thumbs up or thumbs down on this treaty, and he went thumbs down emphatically. But that was after it had been negotiated for like 9 years, and the language was finalized during the Carter administration. So you can imagine when it got to Reagan's desk, he did a full analysis and decided that he was not going to sign on to it. And the treaty is this wide-ranging, comprehensive document that its proponents call a constitution for the oceans. So you can imagine what is in there. Everything from provisions that we don't have a problem with, dealing with navigational rights and freedoms, but also there are provisions that we have a big problem with, which is establishing a new international organization to regulate deep seabed mining, provisions that would sap our resources by requiring us to share oil and gas royalties from developing the continental shelf with the so-called developing world, and other provisions that would expose us to international lawsuits where there's going to be a great deal of mischief in the event that we would be stupid enough to join this treaty. These lawsuits would be brought against us by other countries. So a very controversial treaty. It's never been debated on the Senate floor, and Senator Kerry is going to try to change that this year. And
he's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, of course.
That's correct. And so he's going to have hearings, I think, starting a week from today at the Foreign Relations Committee with the aim of trying to get this to the Senate floor and get the U.S. to sign on to it, to ratify it.
Right. You know, interestingly enough, I was in a meeting, I think, day before yesterday, Steve Groves, where somebody recounted an excerpt of Dinesh D'Souza's book about Reagan, in which he described Al Haig, his first Secretary of State, coming in and insisting that we had to go along with the international community on this Law of the Sea Treaty, and Reagan gently but firmly said no. That's what this election was about, and apparently, according to D'Souza, Haig looked quizzically. He said it was about the Law of the Sea Treaty, and Reagan said no. It was about not having to do things just because everybody else thinks it's a good idea. And you're right, he looked at this critically, sought changes to it, was rebuffed, and said, no, we're not going to sign on to it. Steve Groves, have any of those fundamental problems that President Reagan identified with the treaty, particularly with respect to our sovereignty, been subsequently addressed and thereby made no longer reason to be opposed to it?
I mean, you'll get argument on both sides on this. My view is that when they did try to, quote-unquote, fix some of the provisions that President Reagan balked about, they tried but failed to do so. And, you know, this was done, you know, I like to say, you know, the final negotiation on the treaty was done during the Carter administration. The negotiation on renegotiating the deep seabed provisions was done during the Clinton administration. So I'm not going to be, in either case, as a conservative, my gut tells me that it probably did not have a great outcome.
I think that's not just a conservative's perspective on it, Steve Groves, frankly. I think that's an objective analysis. Quickly, we're going to run out of time here, Steve. I want to talk about two things. You have addressed the two critical interest groups, shall we say, that are at least most in evidence at the moment promoting this treaty. The environmentalists seem to be taking a back seat, though it's really the most egregious and overreaching environmental treaty in history, which is a problem we'll come back to with you on another occasion, perhaps. But talk to us about why the United States Navy's interest in this treaty is misplaced, given that they're making the argument that, you know, they've got to have this treaty to assure their right of passage in various places around the world.
Yes, the Navy is a big fan of the treaty, but their interests are narrow and parochial. You know, they see the navigational rights and freedoms section of the treaty that we as conservatives really don't have an objection to. Reagan didn't have an objection to it.
That was kind of the point of the whole treaty to begin with, was to get that done. But it's everything else, right?
Yeah, it's all the other garbage that's in the treaty that the Navy really doesn't really care about. I mean, their lawyers like to have these rules of the road written down in the treaty, and they think that they can best preserve those rules by the U.S. being a party. But the problem with that claim is there's no evidence to support it. There's no example, there's no law, there's no fact that would indicate that unless we join the treaty, we can't enjoy those navigational rights and freedoms. So I just think that they're wrong-headed on this, and you know they don't care about these royalty revenue-sharing provisions or deep seabed mining or these environmental lawsuits that could come. That's something they see as somebody else's problem.
Yeah, but and yet they are lending their prestige and imprimatur to trying to get a treaty that would have those other negative effects. And let's drill down on this, if I may use that expression, the new paper from the Heritage Foundation. Its principal author, again, is with us, Stephen Groves. Tell us why the oil and gas industry, which is also championing ratification of this treaty urgently, is wrongheaded in so doing.
Well, like the Navy, they seem to think that they need this treaty to best perform their job. And for years, I think they got away with that claim by saying that unless we're a part of the treaty, the oil and gas exploration and development can't go beyond 200 nautical miles onto the what's called the extended continental shelf. And I think that argument carried water for a long time, but as I show in the paper, beginning in August 2001, the Department of Interior started leasing areas on the extended continental shelf in the Gulf of Mexico to these oil and gas companies, both U.S. and foreign companies. So their argument that being a party to the treaty is absolutely essential to developing our extended continental shelf, I think is really eroded away completely.
Indeed. And again, folks, this is going to come before the United States Senate in high probability, all other things being equal, at least. Certainly go through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the near future. We all need to be looking at this in terms of what it will mean for the sovereignty and security and economic interests of the United States. No better guide to these problems than the work of Stephen Groves at the Heritage Foundation. Check out at heritage.org his new backgrounder dated May 14th entitled U.S. Accession to UN Convention on the Law of the Sea Unnecessary to Develop Oil and Gas Resources. Find out more about this treaty and what's wrong with it also at the Coalition to Protect American Sovereignty. It is an outfit that we're helping, along with Steve Groves and many others, to use as a teaching tool about the treaty. We'll be visiting with you, I know, Steve, and many others about what's wrong with the Law of the Sea Treaty in the days ahead. Thanks for your superb work. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon.
Thank you, Frank.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by a woman I have come to know a little bit and admired greatly, mostly from afar. Her name is Peggy Mast. She is a state representative in the House of Representatives in Kansas. She is the assistant majority leader in the House there and has been the leader on an important initiative and has achieved its most recent and signal success in what's known as the American Laws for American Courts initiative. And Representative Mast, first of all, I just want you to know how greatly appreciated your leadership has been. Give us just a quick reminder of what American Laws for American Courts is all about and a sense of what it entailed to get it through, as you have now done, the state legislature in Kansas.
American Laws for American Courts just basically restates that our court system should just go by the rulings of the U.S. Constitution and the Constitution of the state of Kansas. It is actually, I think, a great protection for the Sixth Amendment of our Constitution as well. It's letting people know that whenever they go to the court systems in Kansas, they will have free and equal access of no matter what religion they come from, no matter what background they have, what culture they come from, because in a lot of the other legal systems that are coming up culturally, there is not equal access to women and children, and And I had a real burden about this, and that's why I thought this legislation was very important.
Yeah. Give me a little bit more specific example, if you would, Representative Mast, as to what is the problem with American courts using American laws. It would seem to be self-evident that that's what they would do. Is that not the case?
I think that judges become conflicted when an agreement has been made, particularly like a marriage agreement has been made in another country, and they come over to the United States. When it comes to the court system, the individual, that usually the male, is going to argue that under his cultural laws, the woman should not get any possessions, or shouldn't get custody of the children.
This would be Sharia specifically.
Yes, Sharia actually came up in a court case in Kansas.
But the law, as you've drafted it, does not specify Sharia. This would apply to any foreign laws. Is that right?
That's exactly right. This is not specific to Sharia, although we have organizations now that are claiming that this is anti-Islamic, anti-Sharia. This is, you know, any organization that claims that is basically, to me, saying that they don't believe that people should have equal access if they come from a different culture, that they shouldn't be able to seek justice in our courts.
Now, some of the groups that are making these claims are well known, I think, to our audience, Peggy Mast. They're the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and the like, many of whom have been closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, which ought to tell us something about their opposition. Give us a sense of what happened as you sought the support of your colleagues in the House and in the Senate in Kansas for American laws for American courts.
Well, the biggest problem that I had when I first initiated the bill was a lack of engagement from House members that it was actually an issue that needed to be addressed. They thought that I was addressing a problem that did not exist. And for that, then, a lot of people need educated that this is a legitimate problem. And if we just see the impact that this type of activity from CARE and impact has had over in Europe and other nations, I don't understand why we should be so naive not to think it's coming here.
Right. And specifically, you mentioned just a moment ago, but I cut you off, I'm afraid, there was a case that came to your attention in the latter moments of this process. You had already achieved considerable success. You had turned around a lot of these legislators. I think, in fact, you got 120-0 vote out of your chamber in favor of this American Laws for American Courts bill. And at about that time, you were running into problems in the Senate when somebody came up on the net and said, hey, listen, there's a real case here that ought to be looked at as an example of what's happening in Kansas courts. How did that play into the ultimate resolution, and where are we now?
That really gave a substantive push, because people repeatedly said, well, show us one case in Kansas, show us one case in Kansas. And, oh, that was a real inspiration to me to find out that there was one that has been in the process of being adjudicated since 2010, and it still hasn't been resolved. And this individual, this male, had married, this was his third wife. The two previous wives had gotten absolutely nothing, including custody of their own children, because they had, I don't think that they were, they were totally unaware of the rights that they had as a U.S. citizen. This woman, particular woman, became knowledgeable of the options that she had, and she did choose to go to American courts, and I think that the judge is conflicted.
Yeah. So you got, with that example in hand, the attention of your colleagues, and yet you still ran into resistance very similar to sort of some skullduggery, which is the only way I can describe it, that we saw in several other states recently, Georgia and Florida among them, that kept this legislation, Texas before that, I think, this legislation from being enacted despite overwhelming support. What was the outcome in the Senate, and how did you get there?
it would be humorous if it weren't such a serious topic. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I had given him information, you know, tried to educate him for 2 years because the bill had actually been in the Senate for over a year. And I had just tried to educate him and prepare him, and he gave us 2 hearings. We had very good testimony from very key people that understand the topic very well. And we got nothing, no action taken in the committee process. And so at the 11th hour of regular session, we took the House bill and put it into a Senate bill by maneuvering through the House Judiciary Committee. That sent the bill to conference, and in the conference...
So you effectively bypassed the Judiciary Committee in the Senate.
We did, although we had the hearings, and we passed it out of the House 3 times before we got any action in the Senate, and the most votes that we had against the bill was the very first time it passed, and that was with only 2 votes of opposition. The rest of the time it was unanimous. And so we get into the Senate, and we basically, through the Senate Judiciary Committee wanting particular negotiations to take place with the House, they decided finally that they, and the pressure that they got from the people at home, I just want the people that are listening to understand the importance of the emails, the letters, and the phone calls of the people back home putting pressure on this particular conference committee. This was invaluable. It was, we couldn't have done it without that, and I want to encourage people at home to understand the value and the power that they have over the legislative process if they just engage.
Yeah. Peggy Mast is, again, our guest, and this is a marvelous insight into the process by which in state after state after state we've seen legislators like you recognizing that American citizens, particularly women and children, are being denied their constitutional rights in this country as a result of judges applying foreign law, and principally Sharia, this Islamist code that is very brutal to them and repressive. And thanks to the leadership that you've exhibited, Peggy Mast, of the 76th District of Kansas, and your role as an assistant majority leader in the House there, you have overcome long odds and defeated some of the Muslim Brotherhood front groups and done it with the help of an inspired electorate. And it's a model for the rest of the country. We hope that you will help take that model elsewhere, because your leadership is really exemplary and deeply appreciated, certainly by all of us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Keep up the great work, and I hope we'll be able to stay in touch with you as you turn to other tasks that may also require some support from the public as well. God bless you in the meantime, and thank you for joining us, and we will thank all of you for joining us as well. We'll talk with you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Want the big picture on national security and foreign policy? Find out what Ronald Reagan meant by peace through strength at securefreedomradio.org. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.